people who were going to develop this land, and that they shouldn't be in possession of this, and that the people who should really be helped are the newcomer settlers who were arriving. That is, their industry should be the ones that are augmented. And this competition was felt in all sorts of ways. In the area of the Treaty 6 district of northern Saskatchewan, or central Saskatchewan, the farmers there were very jealous of the hay resources and felt that on the reserves that Indians shouldn't be raising their own cattle, for example. They shouldn't be having the large herds. That this should be the purview of the new settlers, that they should be able to supply people on the reserves with beef cattle. And for this reason, it was argued, for example, that their hay lands, their hay resources, should be cut back so significantly. And we shouldn't forget what a huge market the Indian reserves were for beef cattle, and really some of the huge ranches that were established in the early years in Alberta, in southern Alberta. They were there for essentially the purposes of rationing the Indian reserves. So there were these powerful reasons why people, the new settlers, didn't feel that Native people should be raising cattle. And it also extended to grain as well. And this was the key period to me, was the period of the late 1880s, when it was argued that they shouldn't be competing in the grain markets either. And it was this era of competition that I've argued that led to the formulation of policies in Ottawa that would ensure that Native farmers could not compete and would not compete with the new settlers.
According to conventional history of the prairies, efforts to develop an indigenous farm economy eventually failed because the indigenous peoples weren't used to farming. But according to Sarah Carter, in the first decade of the treaties, while the Canadian government still honored its commitments to assist indigenous farmers, the reserve farms flourished. Carter says the effort to establish a native farm economy collapsed only after the government introduced new policies favoring the new settlers. Not only did the government restrict Native people's access to cattle, it outlawed reserves selling produce without a license. And it restricted Native farmers to obsolete instruments, such as wooden plows. The result was predictable. In the words of one author, the reserves went from wooden plows to welfare. With their farm economy sabotaged, and access to wild game and crops either restricted by the terms of the treaties, or overridden by subsequent amendments to the Indian Act, many reserves became ever more dependent on a federal government that had no interest in fostering an independent Native economy.
That's really the point of the entire book. I think they made a show of making an effort, but I don't believe there was ever this interest. And I think Helen Buckley's book, From Wooden Plows to Welfare, shows she goes beyond the era that I've dealt with to show that there was never this interest in government in establishing viable economies on reserves, that the government has always acted in the interests far more of non-Native peoples, the non-Native settlers. These people are always more powerful economically and politically. As you said, Native people have always been, at least those who are on reserves, treaty people, have always been regarded as wards of the government. They've been economically and politically powerless, and their interests have consistently been overlooked in favor of the interests of non-Native people. And this still continues until this day, so that whenever there is any agitation to have, say, something established on a reserve, it might be a shopping center, it might be a gasohol plant, anything, the neighboring town will always object that if there is to be any money that is to be put into this part of the world, into this community, that it should be gone, it should be given to the town, it shouldn't go to a reserve, that these people, the attitude of peoples has been consistent on the prairies from the very earliest days, that this is unfair, that Native people on reserves are provided for anyway, that they're given all sorts of government assistance. At least I believe that's the dominant image. And they should not be assisted to any greater extent. I find that's what I found in the 1880s and 1890s, and it really does continue to this day.
My name is Craig Benjamin. This half-hour documentary is part of the series Hearing the Voice of the Land, Essays on Food, Ecology, and rural communities. As we've just heard, competition between native farmers and the new settlers in the late 1800s undermined efforts to establish an independent native farm economy on the prairies. But were the new settlers really the winners in this competition? 100 years later, we might wonder how many of their descendants are still on the land. And by the end of this decade, how many will be left? From the standpoint of the present farm crisis, we can look back at the betrayal of the reserve farmers and ask whether the new settlers may also have lost out in this process of settling and unsettling the land. The Canadian government justified its decision to restrict native farmers to wooden plows on the grounds that a hunting culture could not expect to take up European farming in a single step. In European culture, farming and hunting are distinct activities. Of the two, farming is more advanced, more civilized. Such a distinction has long blinded non-natives to the ecological knowledge of indigenous people who make no such sharp distinction between hunting and farming. Earlier we heard that some indigenous people had begun farming on the prairies even before the time of the treaties. We also need to recognize that in the acts of hunting and gathering, indigenous peoples were also exercising a sophisticated knowledge of the prairie environment, a knowledge that could have helped new settlers. According to Sarah Carter, for a brief period in prairie history, some new settlers did attempt to learn from and even emulate native cultures. This was particularly true in the interaction of settler and native women. One consequence of Canadian Indian policy was to isolate new settlers from this knowledge.
Well, I have found some interesting evidence that women did interact in what I would call the early settler period, and that it seems to have almost all but disappeared with the consolidation of settlements, say, after 1900. But yes, I have found some interesting evidence that on some of the isolated farms that women, native women and the new settler women, did become, in some instances, friends. And I found some other really most fascinating evidence of the use of native midwives, but also how women, the new women, drew on the knowledge of Aboriginal women in order to diversify the subsistence base of the farm so that while men were concentrating on grain, and in this era really just one grain, that is wheat, that women were picking up, I think, a lot of the knowledge of Aboriginal women about how what to use in this environment, that is the burying. For example, it wasn't until the early settlers to the Qu'Appelle saw Native women picking berries that they realized that Saskatoon berries weren't poisonous, and that this became an enormous industry for women in Western Canada, that is, not only just drying them and preserving them for their own use, but also selling Saskatoons to augment their farm income. So I think there's all sorts of ways in which women learn from each other. I don't think it can be too much overemphasized. That is, I think that there was likely, and my research is pointing to this as well, that there came a time when there was competition for these scarce resources as well, and that policies were enacted to further separate even the women of reserves from these resources that they had traditionally drawn on, which required the ranging over a broad territory, and that the policies acted to separate people and to stop this sort of interaction. And I guess the only thing that I might add is that my research about women is preliminary, and I don't wish to suggest that there was some golden age of relations when people did interact as equals. I do have some doubts about that. I just like to suggest that there were opportunities for interaction, that it is unfortunate that these opportunities did not blossom and flower, and that it became such a segregated society.
In England, modern agriculture began with the enclosure movement, when common lands were fenced in for the benefit of the few. Everywhere capitalist agriculture has been instituted, the process has been the same. That which is shared among neighbors, that which is handed down from one generation to the next, is everywhere destroyed. the segregation of settler and indigenous communities, and the fencing off of the prairies into family farms and reserves was also a kind of enclosure. But the question, once again, is who benefited? Although the treaties formalized indigenous title to the reserve lands, indigenous farmers were unable to use this title to develop an independent native farm economy, because control over their lives ultimately rested with the Indian Act and an indifferent or hostile federal government. According to agriculture critic Brewster Neen, in the long run, title to the land has also failed to provide security of tenure for the settler farmers and their descendants.
Farmers have been long, and I think indoctrinated would be the right term, that in order to be able to farm with some security, they had to own the land. But ownership and tenure may be two quite different phenomena. And I think some people are beginning to realize that as they recognize that if they have the title, but a bank or the Farm Credit Corporation has the mortgage on the place, that they're not very secure.
Enclosure does not take place without resistance. In 1870, 1 year before the federal government initiated the treaty process, Métis farmers and hunters in Red River took up arms to resist a federal survey of their land. For Brewster Neen, the segregation of native and settler societies had less to do with the threat of similar rebellions, as with the need to build fences between capitalist and indigenous systems of land tenure. This was because indigenous systems, in many ways, represent a real alternative to dependence on a farm economy dictated by the business elite of Central Canada. In other words, a real alternative to enclosure.
Well, of course, there's always been alternatives, and that was what was threatening. As you say, the alternative needed to be disappeared, as it were, because of the threat that any dynamic alternative would provide in terms of landowning. And it is curious that even in some of the western prairies, in the foothills and so on, where ranching was major, the patterns of early settlement were very similar to and virtually identical to what the native people's patterns of settlement had been. They weren't settled, actually. It was a migratory kind of farming. And it wasn't until into this century that in many ways, that was land was divided up in order to assert claims. So that our notion of ownership and this kind of exclusion is, in fact, quite modern and quite limited. The alternatives are there, and that's what we do need to look at.
I was born here in this house. This is where I was born, and this bluff was here when I grew up, and it's still here today. There was a large barn here in the yard, which I said lost the fire. And also sloughs. I don't know if you're familiar with that word, but it's low area, like not really marshy, but it is a wet area. Mm-hmm. And in the spring they fill up with water, and then as the water dries out, you can usually mow the hay or take it to feed for the cattle.
It's October 14th. Gordon Harvey is showing us around his farm near Strathclair in western Manitoba. Yesterday, Gordon and Stella Harvey held an open house to celebrate their 32nd wedding anniversary. 32 years ago, they moved into a small house on the edge of this farm. They have survived. You might even say they've prospered. They fixed up their house and added new rooms. They bought more land from their neighbors, and they expanded their farm. They planted trees to make shelter belts, and they managed to preserve some of the wetlands and some of the wild grasses. But despite all of this, sometimes they wonder how much longer they can hang on.
The building site over there was empty, and then fell over here. His brother-in-law moved in. He doesn't farm the land. Fell over here owns the land. But his brother-in-law lives in there and works all trucking. And then my nephew lived in this house, but we bought the farm down the road, and he did move down the road. So he built a trailer in there. The next farm has been vacant for many years, since 1959. The neighbors further down the road bought it, and another quarter across the road, it's been vacant since about 1970. The other farm we bought was 1960, the fellow moved away. Another one down the road here, he moved away 10 years ago, 1982. Oh, they're all over, eh?
Gordon and Stella inherited their farm from Gordon's parents. They would like their own children to someday come home and take up farming. But for that to be possible, the Harveys say, fundamental changes have to be made in the way people live on the land. One alternative they are exploring is pooling land with their neighbors to form a communal land trust.
If we went into a land trust, you would have, there'd be a small, be a lease agreement, and the payments would probably be smaller. Like, instead of having the heavy mortgage, which I do on the land, my mortgage now runs around $40 per cultivated acres. But if you went into the lease program, it would probably run around 12. In other words, you'd be able to survive instead of, as we do at the moment, we just scrounge to try and make this mortgage.
When the prairies were settled by the Europeans and their descendants, particularly from the 1870s onward, it was sold to people on the basis of this was an opportunity to own a piece of land. I have the impression that in a way that you have this whole history of emphasis on private ownership in the prairies, that a land trust is just an utterly contrary notion.
That's true. Our ancestors, on our trip back to Scotland, we found out that they were on these large estates. Now, they came from Europe to get away from that, and they did. My parents came here, and as many other people did, to buy the land to have this home. And that's great. But no one knew that the prices would be so poor, or there'd be so much pressure on the farm people, or the debt would build up to such a degree that they would have to look at an alternative to stay here. Because right now, I feel that there are large corporations, or I don't know what's happening, but if it's the governments, but somewhere along the way, it's going back to exactly what happened in Europe. That they really would like to see these large farms and one person or two people in control of the land. And sure, they'll say to you, you can stay on the land, but they'll rent the land to you. But I think they would just have you working as a slave for them. And certainly, I think most people really like to stay with their private ownership of land, naturally. But this is an alternative, I think, in order to keep people here. It's something that the prairies are starting to look at. I don't know what else we can do.
I guess just one sort of final point on all of this, and this comes again from something that came up in conversation with Bruce Dernien, talking about the first settling of the prairies by Europeans, and talking today about the farm crisis and ways out of it, particularly about land trusts. And he said that one of the real obstacles that people like yourselves who want to make a change are going to have to face is that, for a large part, farmers don't have the vocabulary that nobody does, that we've been so convinced, we've been so sold on the present system that it's hard to even see the alternatives.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's true. As I mentioned earlier, going to farm meetings when in the early 60s after we were married, it was all geared to using all the chemicals and borrowing money and all this, and and now the land trust concept, people are a little leery of it. In fact, we had one meeting here in the church last winter, and we had a fellow came and told us a bunch of communists, and he sat there all evening and he said, oh, you're no good, you people are just going to destroy our whole country. And we all sat there and says, well, but we're losing our farms. What alternative have we got? And he says, well, I don't know, rent it to me, or rent it to somebody else. And we said, no, we want to bring our families back. Like we have in our particular farm here, 7 quarters. Well, that's enough land, surely, for two or three families to live off, not just two of us. But, he said, oh, no, you must become much larger. You must go from 700 cultivated acres, which we have, into 2,000 acres, which, oh, yeah, sure. Go and rent more land, he said. You'll survive that way. But don't go into this land trust. And we said, well, we can't see any other way, any other route. And our towns are dying. The businesses are closing. The schools, the enrollment is going down. The costs are going up. I mean, our taxes are so high here, and I'm sure it's the same way all over. But I mean, we can only carry on this way so long. We've got to change. And I think it'll be a slow process. It may take many years, but I think as we start talking about it, it will come about. And I think that the time is right.
You've been listening to the first program in the series, Hearing the Voice of the Land, Essays on Food, Ecology, and Rural Communities. Contributors to this documentary were Manitoba grain farmer Gordon Harvey and authors Sarah Carter and Bruce Dernien. Sarah Carter's book, Lost Harvest, Prairie Indian Reserve Farmers and Government Policy, was published by McGill Queen's University Press. In addition to the Ram's Horn, the monthly newsletter of food systems analysis, Bruce Dernien is the author of From Land to Mouth, Trading Up, and The Rape of Canola. For more information about this documentary, this series, or about other programs available through the Cassette Culture Catalog, please write. Our address is 168 Arthur Street North, Guelph, Ontario, N1E 4V5. Funding for this documentary was provided by McLean Hunter through Canadian Artists and Programs on Satellite. All music was by Jeffrey Mitchell. Thanks are also due to Maizun Jayusi of CJSW-FM at the University of Calgary. The program was produced in the studios of CFRU-FM in Guelph. I'm Craig Benjamin. Thank you for listening.
Archives. Episode 1 of Hearing the Voice of the Land, Settling and Unsettling, a series by Cassette Culture, CFRU in Guelph, back in 1993. Here on Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby, campus community radio from Simon Fraser University. I am Jesse, and we're just about done this hour. Just a little bit more music to bring you up until 11 a.m. when Democracy Now! Will begin. We are going to do something fun and sweet, and hopefully it won't put you to sleep. But these are synthesized lullabies by Calarissa, a local experimental pop synthy artist, Larissa Lovia, who put together a record of original songs for her nephew on the occasion of his first birthday. And so we're going to hear one of those lullabies. This is called Float, and you'll just float right on until Democracy Now!, and I will see you next week with more talk stuff. Yeah, see you then.
Are you interested in radio? Community-based media? You can join CJSF 90.1. We're a volunteer-run community radio station, and we always have space for new volunteers to become programmers, review music, edit audio, and so much more. All the training is provided, and anyone can join. To volunteer, email our volunteer coordinator, Noel, at vol_4_CJSF@sfu.ca. Again, that's vol_4_CJSF@sfu.ca. Or you can visit our website, cjsf.ca. It's CJSF 90.1, diverse, independent, and yours.